Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
A new study suggests Earth could have lost up to 60% of its atmosphere in the collision of space objects that created the moon. Most scientists believe this event happened about 4 billion years ago, when Earth was still developing. They think a massive object, possibly the size of the planet Mars, hit the Earth, sending vaporized particles into space. Gravity is believed to have brought these particles together to form the moon. The study presents evidence that this collision might have caused Earth to lose between 10 to 60% of the atmosphere it had. A report on the study appeared in the publication Astrophysical Journal Letters. The researchers' impact hypothesis is one of three leading theories of how the moon was formed. The others suggest the moon was either created at the same time as Earth, or that it was captured by Earth's gravitational field as it traveled through space. The researchers decided to explore how massive collisions of objects affected rocky planets with thin atmospheres. To do this, they carried out more than 300 supercomputer simulations. The experiment considered the positions at which the objects hit the planet, the speed of the impacts, as well as the size and mass of the colliding object. Earlier research suggested that impact collisions during the latter stages of the formation of a planet can affect its atmosphere. The computer models in this study expanded on this idea. They showed that a collision, like the one that may have formed the moon, likely took a large part of Earth's atmosphere. The study's lead researcher, Jacob Kegerice, is with Durham University in Britain. He is a cosmologist, a scientist specializing in the beginnings and development of the universe. Kegerice noted in a statement that the computer simulations do not directly explain how the moon was created. However, the effects on the Earth's atmosphere could be used to narrow down the different ways it might have been formed. Kegerice said the study shows a new way to look at how similar collisions led to the loss of atmospheres of other rocky planets. Such methods could be used by scientists investigating how the moon came to be, as well as other very large impacts. The study also suggests that large, slow-moving impacts between newer planets and massive objects could add to the planet's atmosphere if the colliding object also has its own atmosphere. The researchers say they hope the study will give scientists a better understanding of the moon's formation and help to explain how atmospheres develop on other planets. I'm Brian Lynn.
Many people in the United States are returning to changed workplaces after months of lockdowns. New social distancing and cleaning requirements are being put into effect in some places. One big difference is in break rooms, where workers used to drink coffee and talk. Food companies such as Keurig Dr. Pepper, Lavazza, and Nestle have released new technology for these rooms in the time of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Nestle said it has worked with manufacturers to change its coffee makers. The machines let users choose their drinks by holding a finger over a screen, but they do not touch it. Lavazza recently released a new coffee maker that works with a mobile application or app. It can make cappuccinos and lattes, special kinds of coffee drinks, without people having to touch the machine. U.S. coffee machine manufacturer Bun has a different idea. It has added a QR code, a special kind of code, to its current machines. The new code lets users order drinks through a website. Supplying offices with coffee beans and coffee makers is a big business in the United States. Last year, the business research company Packaged Facts said that the market was valued at $5.7 billion. These coffee companies have had sales fall during coronavirus lockdowns, but they hope to improve business by making changes. The goal is to reduce workers' and employers' concerns. Some studies suggest offices will fill up very slowly. Offices might never return to the same number of workers that they had before the coronavirus health crisis. Good Firms is a research company based in Washington, D.C. The company said recently that its international study of 168 businesses showed that nearly one-third of workers had returned to their offices. Nearly 60% wanted to do so, but more than half remained concerned about their safety. Alicia LaBeouf is a marketing and sales official at food service company Canteen. She said changes to office food services were important for dealing with such concerns. Cooks who prepare meals have been replaced by food stations at large companies such as Verizon and United Health Group, Incorporated. Microsoft Corporation has begun using touchless coffee machines. At Mohawk Industries, refrigerators have special, foot-operated doors. At a FedEx building, Canteen has replaced credit card payment with Canteen's Connect and Pay app, which also shows nutritional information. Offices need to change, said Tom Vecchione. He helps plan workplaces at the architecture services company Vocon in New York City. The company is taking down doors and removing screens in offices. The goal is to create larger common areas that make social distancing easier. The company also is replacing chairs with stools to discourage people from staying in one place for too long. I'm John Russell.
drug maker Eli Lilly and Company said it has asked U.S. officials to approve emergency use of an experimental antibody treatment for COVID-19. Lilly said early results of a study show the treatment reduced hospital emergency room visits for persons with mild or moderate forms of COVID-19. It said the therapy also reduced signs of the disease, the amount of the virus, and length of hospital stays for such patients. The company announced the study's partial results before a meeting with investors and the public. The findings have yet to be published or examined by independent scientists. The antibody treatment appears to work like one given to President Donald Trump. The treatment he took was developed by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Both therapies are designed to connect human antibodies to the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 and limit its ability to spread. The antibodies are usually given as a one-time treatment through intravenous therapy. Daniel Skovronsky is a doctor and Eli Lilly's chief scientific officer. He said in a statement, "We believe the data generated to date provide sufficient evidence that both monotherapy and combination therapy may be effective to treat COVID-19 in patients with a high risk for serious outcomes." The monotherapy involves an antibody called Li-CoV-555. The combination therapy combines that antibody with an antibody called Li-CoV-16. The medical news website StatNews reported that Lilly had previously released results for a similar treatment using one antibody, which experts viewed as promising. But the new results of a combination of two antibodies appear, based on limited data provided in a press release, to be more robust. The drug maker is asking the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to permit use of its single antibody treatment in emergency situations. The company expects to seek government approval of the combination treatment in November. At this time, the FDA has only approved the drug remdesivir for emergency use in COVID-19 patients. Lilly said it has already started manufacturing the drug Li-CoV-555. The company expects to have 100,000 doses ready in October and 1 million by the end of the year. It hopes to have 50,000 doses of the combination therapy ready by year's end. The drug maker added that it is also working with regulators around the world to make these treatments available.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart, that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, unless she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico, and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old, as old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this Union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's Constitution. Every member of every Northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.